This is Heart of Iowa with KHOI Radio 89.1 FM, where we explore a patchwork of people and events in our listening area. I'm your host, Jim Werbel, and Paul Hertz is my co-host. Good morning, Paul.
Morning, Jim. It's just afternoon now.
Yes, it is. I've been on a personal campaign to unlock many of the hidden gems in central Iowa. The gem we're exploring today is the Ames Lab. Well, it's not exactly hidden. A lot of people know that it exists, but an informal survey of Ames residents suggests that the activities of the Ames Lab appear to be hidden from the public at large. For example, I asked many people, what was the Ames Lab contribution to the Manhattan Project? And the typical response is very general, something with the nuclear bomb. We'll be talking about the Ames Lab's project involvement with the Manhattan Project in the first half of the show. In the second half, we will be exploring the current activities of Ames Lab. Our guests today are Steve Karstian, who's the Ames Laboratory Public Affairs Manager, Sam Hauk, who's a scientist and a chemistry professor at Iowa State, Adam Schwartz, who's the director of Ames Lab, and Tom LaGrasso, who's the deputy director. Our first guests are Steve and Sam. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jim. Nice to be here.
Thank you, Jim.
I've seen both of them on campus at different times. They really do exist. So Steve has done extensive work collecting oral histories of people at what was at the time called Iowa State College who were involved with the Manhattan Project. Can you tell us quickly the types of information you collected?
Sure. A little bit of background here, Jim. Back in 1992, the Department of Energy wanted to do something to recognize the 50th anniversary of the first self-sustaining chain reaction experiment.
Which happened where?
In Chicago.
Right.
At the University of Chicago. And so all the laboratories were tasked with putting some kind of a recognition event together. I arrived on the scene in October of 1992 at the laboratory, and this event was going to be in December. So coming to the laboratory with a background in broadcast journalism, I thought, well, it's a shame that we haven't interviewed all of these scientists and put those interviews on video tape. And so I gathered them all together, a number of them, about seven of them, I guess, six or seven, and interviewed them at the laboratory and then created a video presentation, a documentary on the contributions they made to the Manhattan Project as Ames Laboratory and Iowa State University scientists.
Interesting.
Well, it was interesting because the gentleman that I interviewed had just fantastic stories, individuals of great integrity, great character. They were so committed and dedicated to the work that they were doing as part of this project. It was just it was a joy, literally, to listen to them tell their story.
We'll hear one of the stories in just a little bit.
Okay.
So as I understand it, Frank Spedding, was a faculty member at Iowa State College, was asked to participate in the Manhattan Project. Can you tell us why he was asked to do so?
Sure. Well, I can give you some background, and then Sam might jump in with some more information. But Frank Spedding received his PhD in the late 20s, and because of the Depression, he was not able to get a full-time job. So he got a fellowship, and it took him on travels around the world, and he met many of the leading scientists at the time who were working on these issues of separating materials. And he came back to this country in 1935 and was at Cornell, still on a fellowship. And it's my understanding that he was traveling from Cornell, or that part of the country, back to the West Coast and arrived at Iowa State University and had a job interview. And they didn't offer him the kind of job that he wanted at the time. It was more of a would put him in the capacity of more of another fellowship, and he wanted a more permanent position.
Mm-hmm.
Traveled down the road, and about a week later, they notified him that they would offer him the kind of job that he wanted. So Spedding's background is in rare earth chemistry. He was a physical chemist, a spectroscopist, and that was of great value to the work being done for the Manhattan Project eventually.
Well, what was, Sam, what was his contribution to the Manhattan Project specifically? Or Ames Lab, too, is that?
Okay. Well, Spedding's contribution, in conjunction with Harley Wilhelm, another Iowa State professor, was that they developed a process for generating purified uranium metal that could be duplicated on a large scale. And so the uranium metal, which was then used in nuclear reactors to produce plutonium, was first purified as metal, either here at the Iowa State College in a separate building, or possibly by other facilities using the same process developed by Spedding and Wilhelm.
Why was uranium so important for creating a sustained nuclear reaction?
Right. Well, uranium is the heaviest common natural element.
It's the heaviest, okay.
Yes. And,
I knew it was at the bottom of the charts, but I didn't know it was that way at the bottom.
Right. And so one of the isotopes or forms of uranium is uranium-235. This is only about 0.7% naturally abundant. So it is a small component of the total uranium. But that particular form of uranium-235 can undergo a fission reaction with neutrons and also has the characteristics necessary to generate a sustained or chain reaction with neutrons. So if you have enough of these uranium-235 atoms separated from the bulk of the other uranium, you can achieve a detonation.
So he, Spedding, created uranium-235.
No. What he did was took natural uranium and converted it into the metallic form, which could be, then be used in nuclear reactors,
okay,
or for other purposes.
Okay, got it. So okay. He made a very purified form of uranium that was first used to first make the sustained nuclear reactor, and then eventually used for fission and for the first atom bomb.
I think that what's important is that, and Sam can chime in on this as well, is that they needed highly pure uranium for the first self-sustaining chain reaction experiment. And there was uranium in the United States and in Canada, but it was impure. And the best place to get it was in the Belgian Congo.
Mm-hmm.
And the Nazis at that time controlled the Belgian Congo, and they had stopped all material of that type of material from leaving that country at the time. So
Okay. They
needed highly pure uranium, and they were desperate to manufacture large quantities of it because they needed large quantities for the pile experiment in Chicago.
All right. Well, it took many players. You mentioned Harley Wilhelm. Tell me about the different players and what each contributions was to the project.
I had to make a list.
Go ahead.
Once I read your question, I made a list. Well, Harley Wilhelm, of course. Well, Frank Spedding, of course, was in charge of the entire project. He brought Harley Wilhelm on board in 1942 to be an associate director of the what they called the Ames Project at that time, because we were not the Ames Laboratory
mm-hmm.
until 1947. But there are a number of individuals who were involved, and what's interesting about this is a number of them were undergraduate students. Some were graduate students. These were all young men who were involved in this project. They were people who were personally tapped by Frank Spedding to be involved in this project. So Harry Svek, who we'll hear
just shortly,
from Kathy a little bit later, he was a glass blower for the project. Obviously, they needed that kind of participation. Norm Carlson worked in analytical chemistry as part of the project. Ray Fisher, who was just a sophomore in chemistry, was tagged by Spedding to work on checking the purity of the uranium that was being processed. Adolf Voigt was a graduate student at that time. C.F. Gray was a metal caster. David Peterson was on the uranium production crew. So you can understand how there were so many different elements involved in this whole process. And a number of those individuals are the ones that I interviewed for the video that I put together.
So Frank Leddett and Harley did what?
Well,
what was his job?
Well, one thing, one of Harley Wilhelm's many skills was he had already developed a spectrographic laboratory which could be used to determine the purity of solid materials.
Explain a spectrograph quickly, Sam.
So in this experiment, a solid sample is heated to high temperatures, hot enough to generate atoms, and then the excited atoms will emit light, much in the same way that the sodium vapor in a street light emits orange light. So the color of the emitted light identifies the element present. Mm-hmm. The intensity of light of a particular color can be used to determine the concentration of the element present. Since they were tasked with making highly pure uranium, it was necessary to have analytical methods to assay the purity of the material, and particularly to look for trace elements with high neutron capture characteristics, because they do not want those in uranium in a reactor, or the neutrons will be lost to the impurity element.
Okay.
So one person that was involved in that work also was Velmer Fassel, one of my major professors.
Okay.
I think the other thing to keep in mind is at this time, Frank Spedding was traveling back and forth to Chicago on a weekly basis. Mm-hmm. And so he needed someone here in Ames to follow up on the things that he wanted the crew in Ames to do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we can talk about that schedule that they kept if you want to or later or whatever. But it was a grueling schedule, and it just needed more than one person involved in the project.
So it's really a project. It was really a team project, what we call project management today.
Yes, and it was a 7-day-a-week, 24-hour-a-day project. These individuals whose names I mentioned, it's not uncommon to hear them say, you know, that they felt like they were working almost 24/7.
Okay, I believe it. Well, let's hear one of the interviews. This is from Kathy Speck, whose father participated in the project. I'd like to welcome Kathy Speck, who's a lifelong resident of Ames and an active member of the Ames Historical Society, to tell us about her father, Harry Speck, who was active in the Ames project.
Thanks, Jim.
Tell us a little bit about how your father got involved with the Ames Lab.
My father got his degree in chemistry, biology, and math in 1941 in Cleveland at John Carroll University. And I'm going to tell you this tidbit because it's important for his story. While he was there, he had taken an interest in technical glassblowing.
Technical glassblowing is important in chemistry for what?
Well, laboratory glass. Scientists would need particular things that were not really on the shelf anywhere. His skill was really extremely important and very technical. But after he graduated from college, he had intended to go to medical school, but his father had died and his mother was not allowed to co-sign a school loan. So Harry thought he would look for programs in biochemistry, and so he applied around to various grad schools. And he ended up accepting Iowa State's offer because of its well-known program in chemistry and because it came with the princely teaching stipend of $54 a month. With many Iowa State teaching staff enlisting and leaving the campus, he was also enjoying an additional stipend as the only available chemistry instructor teaching cadets in the Navy's V-12 officer training program. So at Iowa State, Harry had continued his glassblowing, making affordable apparatus for student colleagues and for faculty members, attracting the positive attention of his major professor.
Mm-hmm.
But you may wonder, all this time his draft board back in Cleveland had been deferring him based on his teaching. But the deferment suddenly ended in the spring of 1944.
I was kind of wondering how he got out of the draft.
Yes.
So it was the teaching that did it.
It was the teaching that did it. But that deferment suddenly ended in the spring of 1944 as the military was gearing up for D-Day and the European invasion. So Harry reported to Fort Snelling. After some time, he realized that the room was mostly empty. Thinking he had missed his call, he approached the desk. The sergeant ran his finger down the list, saying, "Spec, spec, spec. Ah, here you are. You're to go down to Ames, Iowa, and meet a guy named Spedding." He was relieved, of course, and returned to Ames by bus, all the while curious about the turn of events.
Exactly.
And it turned out the reason was serendipitous. The year before, at the recommendation of his major professor, he had been asked to take over glassblowing activity in the chemistry department. One of his best customers was Frank Spedding and his secret project.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
So when Harry arrived back in Ames, he met Spedding on the front stoop of the chemistry building and was invited to join his secret project. The secrecy was really, really absolute.
Top secret.
Top secret. Spedding explained to Harry, "We could not afford to lose the only glass blower that we had, so Harry was key to the project." Harry agreed to the invitation but stated that he wanted to be involved in the research, not just blow glass. And Spedding did agree to that, provided that Harry taught someone else to blow glass, which he did. So Harry received his security clearance and a key to the work. Harry also brought special knowledge about high vacuum techniques. Harry's expertise in high vacuum techniques involved obtaining and measuring pressures down to 10 to the minus 6 millimeters of mercury, in other words, 1/1,000,000th of an atmosphere. No one in chemistry at Iowa State was familiar with these techniques, so his expertise was put to use immediately in upgrading the casting of uranium. Like all other scientists working on the project, Harry was sworn to secrecy. As he said, secrecy was almost absolute. "My mother had no idea what he was working on, and she was often questioned by others about why Harry had not been drafted. He, like many involved in the secret work, was sometimes considered unpatriotic."
So it's a little like the movie Bridge of Spies, where what's-his-name went to East Germany and couldn't tell his wife or family what the story was.
Could not tell. So on the day the news broke about the dropping of the atomic bomb, Harry was in the basement of the chemistry building in Old Room 103. Then he later gathered with other workers in an upstairs lab to listen to the radio. He says, "I was surprised and relieved. Everything we had done had come to successful fruition."
Mm-hmm.
Then he went home and told my mother, "That's what we've been working on." So the immersion in the Manhattan Project at Iowa State completely changed the direction of Harry's graduate program. After the war project ended, Spedding became his major professor, and Harry went on to build the first two mass spectrometers that were used at Iowa State. That was new technology at the time that Spedding was interested in investigating.
I've heard those spectrometers were really important for future other things related to Ames Lab at the time.
Oh, they were. And Ames Lab came to be known for its specialty in rare earth research.
Mm-hmm. This is your host, Jim Werbel, along with my co-host, Paul Hertz, and guests Steve Karsgen and Sam Houck. We are talking about Ames Lab, or at the time it was called the Ames Project, as Steve was saying, and its involvement with the Manhattan Project. So we've been talking about the purification of uranium. Sam, can you describe how they made purified uranium? What was the process that they used?
Well, uranium metal doesn't exist in nature and had to be made from various ores. And so the starting material for the process in Ames was a compound between uranium and fluorine, which was mixed with solid magnesium metal or powder. And then the entire mixture was put in a sealed vessel, heated to very high temperatures. The resulting reaction, the fluorine atoms were removed from the uranium atoms and converted to the magnesium form. And what was then left was uranium metal, which gathered in the bottom of these metal casks in which the reaction was done. So the result was uranium solid ingots of quite high purity as a natural result of the way in which the reaction took place. So the entire mixture done in a sealed metal vessel was then cooled down. The uranium ingot was extracted. Quality control analysis was done on the ingot to measure its purity. But just by this single process alone, quite highly pure uranium metal, not otherwise previously available, could be manufactured in large-scale production quantities.
Large-scale production. So this was a... I've heard, at least watching the video, that there was something called Little Ankeny on campus. Can you tell us about it? It was right on campus. Could you tell us about it?
Sure. Anybody who's familiar with the layout of campus, depending on how old you are, I guess, would remember Carl Hamilton Hall, which is the present Greenlee School of Journalism.
Okay.
And the Dairy Industries building was right beside that. And then sort of wedged right in that area was a wooden building.
Kind of like the farmhouse, except a different building.
And not nearly as good a shape as the farmhouse, I don't think. That building was being used at the time as a combination popcorn laboratory, research laboratory, and a women's gymnasium. So when Spedding wanted to ramp up the production work and move it out of Gilman Hall, mm-hmm.
Which is the chemistry building.
The chemistry building, yes, correct. When, just backing up a little bit, when they first signed the contract after the chain reaction experiment, they were producing 100 pounds of uranium a week. So they needed to ramp that up, and eventually they went to like 3,600 pounds a week and then 36,000 pounds a
week. That's a lot.
Yes. So they had to ramp that up in its own facility. And so there was this wooden structure on campus, and they moved into it. Interesting story from Harley Wilhelm. They needed a machine shop, and Harley found one in Ames that was for sale, and they moved the entire machine shop, lock, stock, and barrel to the Little Ankeny site, and then they hired the owner of the machine shop to come and run it for the project in the Little Ankeny facility. It was called Little Ankeny. The official name of it was Physical Chemistry Annex, but they called it Little Ankeny because they wanted to throw people off because this was all top secret. Mm-hmm. And there happened to be a munitions plant down in Ankeny, Iowa,
right,
that was manufacturing bullets.
Yeah.
And so they named it Little Ankeny, thinking people would think they were doing the same kind of work that they
bullets,
were doing,
yeah,
down there.
Interesting, interesting. Talking about security, Kathy Speck, in summarizing some of her father's comments, mentioned a lot about security. With so many people, how did this stay relatively quiet? She actually, in talking to her, she mentioned that there was a lot of speculation going on campus, what was going on, but no one quite knew. So the security really was very good.
I wrote on my notes here one word, security, the threat of the draft made a big difference.
These were all males.
Yes. Like Kathy was talking about, you know, Harry was going to be drafted, but he was pulled back. Every one of these guys was draft age, and they were tagged by Frank Spedding to stay and work on this project. I remember one of them, David Peterson, I think it was David, commented that he and a friend went to Minnesota for a day because, as I mentioned, they were working 7 days a mm-hmm. week, basically. And he said when they got back, they got hauled into Frank Spedding's office and read the Riot Act. And he said, you would have thought we had gone AWOL from the military.
Interesting.
Because they didn't want any word getting out about what was going on in relationship to this project.
So that just shooting across a shot across the bow, so to speak, was enough to get people to say, this is really critical. Sam.
So the Ames Project and most of the other national laboratory projects in the Manhattan Project were generally located in relatively remote areas, so people would not just sort of wander in and wonder what was going on. So that's another factor in the security.
I know I was talking with somebody about Los Alamos. Los Alamos actually was a postal station within Santa Fe. And if you've ever been to Los Alamos, they're nearby, but it's like saying Des Moines and Ames are nearby.
One of the other things that they worked very hard to do here to throw people off was sort of invent other things that they could be doing. So Frank Spedding talks about telling people or the community thinking they were making pep pills, he called them, for the military to sort of build them up and increase their energy level and stuff like that. Another one of the scientists said they reported that they were building boxes in one of the facilities was all. So they did whatever they could to throw people off, which was very difficult to do because there was a train that came in to pick up the purified uranium, and it had armed guards on it. It would come in empty looking, and it would leave empty looking, but they were putting the uranium in a false bottom under the train cars. And so it raised a tremendous number of questions about what was going on.
Interesting. Well, why did they stop making uranium on campus, the purified uranium?
Oh, I just think that that other facilities, companies perhaps, picked up on this process and that it could be made as well elsewhere. And so that there once a time came about when the interests and expertise in the Ames Laboratory evolved in other directions, mm-hmm. and so the uranium production process wasn't really necessary here to be done here anymore.
Okay.
But I think for quite a long time, the basic production of uranium metal was still done by something analogous to the process developed here.
However, heavy metals did become an expertise of both the chemistry department as well as Ames Lab, as I understand it.
Right.
And that started from this project. What's unique about heavy metals that is it's a specialty unto itself in chemistry?
Well, they have more of electrons than lighter elements, so their electronic structures are more complex. Some of their chemical properties are different from those of a more common, say, transition elements.
Mm-hmm.
So Spedding, even before the Second World War, was recognized world expert in the chemistry of rare earth elements, and to some extent that has continued and echoed back, I guess, to the Ames Laboratory now.
Okay. Well, there was something. There was some recognition that Ames Lab got. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the recognition in terms of this E-flag?
Sure. If you come to the Ames Laboratory, we have an Army-Navy E-flag on the wall in Spedding Hall. And originally, back in the late 30s, the Army had an award and the Navy had an award. And then those two departments joined, and they produced what was called the Army-Navy E-flag. So the flag says both Army and Navy on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was given out to over 4,000 different entities that contributed to the war effort as part of the Manhattan Project. Iowa State University was the only university to ever receive the Army-Navy E-flag.
Hmm.
And our flag has four stars on it. So you would start working for the project, and after 6 months, you would get your first star.
Mm-hmm.
So we have four stars, which is two and a half years worth of work. Former director Robert Hansen, who I interviewed when we were doing all these other interviews, was a little disappointed. He thought that we should have one more star because he thought we had done a little bit more work for them than what they recognized. And I'd mentioned to you, interestingly enough, I always thought that Iowa State University was the only place in Ames that got an Army-Navy E-flag. And recently, we did a little research on the flag, and it turns out there was another company in Ames that also got an Army-Navy E-flag, and it was because they manufactured raincoats for the military. The difference is, they didn't have any stars on their flag, which would be an indication that they only worked on the project
short
for 6 months.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We've been talking to Steve Karsgen, who's Director of Public Affairs at Ames Lab, and Sam Houck, who's been a professor and also does work at Ames Lab itself. Appreciate you two coming to the show. Mm-hmm. It seems like there's a long history to the Manhattan Project and how it shaped not only that project, but the future directions that the Ames Lab was going to after this project ended.
Mm-hmm. And that's the exciting part, and you're going to hear about that in a little bit.
Thank you.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium. There's yttrium, ytterbium, actinium, rubidium, and boron, gadolinium, niobium, iridium, and strontium, and silicon, and silver, and samarium, and bismuth, bromine, lithium, beryllium, and barium. There's holmium and helium and hafnium and erbium and phosphorus and francium and fluorine and terbium and manganese and mercury, molybdenum, magnesium, dysprosium and scandium and cerium and cesium and lead, praseodymium and platinum, plutonium, palladium, promethium, potassium, polonium and tantalum, technetium, titanium, tellurium and cadmium and calcium and chromium and curium. There's sulfur, californium, and fermium, berkelium, and also mendelevium, einsteinium, nobelium, and argon, krypton, neon, radon, xenon, zinc, and rhodium, and chlorine, carbon, cobalt, copper, tungsten, tin, and sodium. These are the only ones of which the news has come to Harvard. And there may be many others, but they haven't been discovered.
This is KHOI 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames. On today's Heart of Iowa, we're exploring the past and present of the Ames Laboratory. On the first part of the show, we heard about its beginnings in the Manhattan Project, and in this next part, we're going to explore current activities at the Ames Lab. I'm Paul Hertz, and my principal guests for this part of the show are Adam Schwartz, Ames Laboratory Director, and Tom Wilgrasso, the Deputy Director of Ames Lab. Welcome to both of you. Excited to learn about what you've got going on now.
Hi, Paul, and thank you, Jim. Thank you both for the invitation and the opportunity to talk about Ames Laboratory and a few of the really exciting areas of research that we're doing.
Thank you, Paul and Jim, also for this opportunity.
The Ames Laboratory is part of the U.S. Department of Energy. What are the primary interests of the Department of Energy?
So the Department of Energy is a very large, broad, diverse organization with a mission to ensure America's security and prosperity by addressing its energy, environmental, and nuclear challenges through very transformative science and technology solutions in really three specific areas: energy, science and innovation, and nuclear safety and security. So I'd like to talk a little bit about really two of those areas, starting with nuclear safety and security, as that's the history of Ames Laboratory. You may recall just a few months ago all the attention that was given on the Iran nuclear negotiations. Mm-hmm. Well, DOE has multiple foci in this nuclear area. The first, of course, is stockpile stewardship. The nation still maintains an arsenal of nuclear weapons, and one of the Department of Energy's missions is to assure the safety and security and reliability of those weapons. The second area is nonproliferation. We, of course, don't want nuclear weapons spreading across the entire world, so the United States puts significant effort into all of these activities. Very recently, Secretary of Energy Ernest Moniz played a very key role in the Iran negotiations, along with Secretary of State John Kerry. The national labs participated significantly. Secretary Moniz relied heavily on the expertise from the national laboratories during those negotiations.
How many national laboratories are there, and what are some of the names of those laboratories? So Oak Ridge, I know, is one, at Los Alamos, others?
Right. There are 17 Department of Energy national laboratories, and they each have either single-purpose or multi-purpose functions. For the nuclear weapons nuclear security side, you know the name Los Alamos National Laboratory, Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, mm-hmm. and Sandia National Laboratories. For nuclear energy, the primary lab is Idaho National Laboratory. Others nearby, Argonne National Laboratory focuses on science and energy. There's the Oak Ridge, Brookhaven National Lab. Then there's additional laboratories on accelerators, like Stanford has one called SLAC, Thomas Jefferson, Princeton Plasma Physics, and so forth. So in terms of the exciting things going on at Department of Energy now in the area of energy, I'm sure you've heard about the United Nations Climate Change Conference, the Paris talks, it's called COP21. Mm-hmm. It was held in early December. And the outcome from that meeting was truly remarkable. Led by the United States, it's something like 20 countries have all agreed to double their research budgets in the area of renewable energy over the next 5 years. It's called Mission Innovation. Not only are our U.S. government agencies funding it, but also there's a group of about 28 entrepreneurs, investors, and businesses in 10 different countries led by Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates. They will be investing in developing clean energy technologies and getting them out into the market and having an impact on climate, having an impact on our atmosphere. So that's all very exciting. And, of course, not many people may know that DOE is the largest funder of research in the physical sciences, including physics, chemistry, biology, materials. And for basic energy sciences, DOE has a budget of about $1.8 billion. As one of those 17 labs that I just talked about, Ames Laboratory is focused on creating materials and energy solutions for a clean energy technology. In fact, that's our mission. We create materials, we inspire minds to solve problems, and we address global challenges.
How much of that overall budget is Ames Lab? Is it...
We're a tiny speck.
Yeah.
You're not over $1 billion?
No. Some of the laboratories are. Ames Laboratory truly has a very, very focused mission. We are the smallest of the laboratories by far. Our budget, our top-line budget, is about $58 million.
Okay.
But what we spend, what we cost here in Ames, is more like $45 million.
Mm-hmm. What are some recent, I guess since the formation of Ames Lab in 47, some of the really significant, more recent advances made here?
I'll talk maybe about two or three, very briefly, some of mm-hmm. the highlights before talking about kind of what our current focus is. Mm-hmm. One of our biggest successes was the creation of lead-free solder. Lead is poisonous.
We know a lot about lead now.
Yes,
Flint, Michigan's helped get that visible again.
So decades ago, the effort began to pull lead out of paints. You can no longer buy paints that have lead in it. Europe led the charge in getting lead out of electronic equipment, out mm-hmm. of solder. The solder that we all grew up using was lead and tin.
Hmm.
And in an effort to get that out, there was basically a worldwide competition. Who can create a replacement for these leaded solders that is a direct replacement for what is currently being used? Now, Ames Laboratory developed lead-free solder is in every piece of electronic equipment you have, from your cell phones to your monitors to your computers. Really a huge success. Another area that Ames Laboratory had significant contributions was the development of a new type of catalyst, a material that enabled biodiesel production. Starting with basic research, Ames Laboratory scientists invented a new type, a cooperative, a hybrid catalyst that enabled the conversion of feedstock to biodiesel using lower temperatures and lower pressures, basically increasing the efficiency to be able to produce biodiesel from more diverse crops than we have now.
That sounds like something that you'd be working with the College of Agriculture here on, not just the physics and chemistry departments.
Absolutely. There are collaborations across much of campus between the Ames Laboratory, and we'll talk about a little bit more about that coming up. So let me introduce Tom LaGrasso. One of the areas that we are really excited about is our work in critical materials. So, Tom?
Well, let me start by answering a question. What are critical materials? Critical materials are those materials that are essential for technology, for transportation, to the U.S. economy. The question really is, do we have enough material to deploy clean energy technology? As you see across Iowa, we have windmills dotting the countryside. Each of those windmills, the generators, have magnets in them.
Mm-hmm.
Those magnets are made of rare earth metals. And I think there was a discussion earlier. Ames Lab was a pioneer in rare earth metals. Mm-hmm. The rare earths are not common metals like iron and copper. They have funny names for the ones that...
I think we heard all of them.
Did you hear
them? Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. But they're really important for making permanent magnets. And in particular, they make the strongest permanent magnets. So things like the motors in your car can be made smaller, and therefore cars can be lightened.
Hmm.
And get improved gas mileage from them. The wind turbines that I talked about, it's key for that. Cell phones, earbuds, earphones. Magnets are everywhere, and these powerful magnets really have allowed technology to advance, not just in energy generation, but in your everyday life.
So what is Ames Lab's contribution with magnets? I mean, think magnets are relatively simple, but I guess not.
No, it's a bit complicated. Because of their rare earth content, it was about 30 years ago, the U.S. was the source, primary source of rare earth metals. But over time, the Chinese, which have vast resources, have developed those natural resources. And roughly about in 2010, the Chinese had 95% of the manufacturing base for rare earths and rare earth magnets. The world kind of became aware of the importance of rare earths in all of our technology following an incident that happened in the Sea of Japan. Japan seized a Chinese fishing trawler captain who had strayed into controversial waters. Well, the response from the Chinese was to impose some sanctions on the Japanese, which include withholding rare earth imports into Japan. And actually, that did raise concerns globally. The United States, Japan, Europe kind of took note of this and started to talk about, well, what do we do about critical materials? Because if you can't get the magnets, then, well, we can't build anything, really. In the end, Department of Energy developed a strategy that's focused on clean energy technology and what are the materials that are important for clean energy technologies. And teams formed from all over the country. The Ames Lab led a team, and it was a successful team. We won the award for the Critical Materials Institute in January of 2013. The strategy, really, it's somewhat simple. If you need something and you don't have enough of it, you either find more of it or you find something else that can do just as good, or you make better use of what you do have. So it's a three-pronged strategy to increase supply, develop substitutes, or to improve the reuse and recycle of the materials. So in each of these three areas, the laboratory is leading a consortium of national labs, universities, and private industries. Together as a team, we are trying to develop better separations technology for separating the rare earths and to improve the efficiency of those separations and the economics, developing new magnet materials or improved magnet materials, new phosphors for screens and for fluorescent lighting, as well as developing the recycling technologies we need.
And those are all very important areas.
Everyday things we use.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes, it's the mission. It seems like the mission of the lab is still very focused on energy, but it's moved from highly secretive things producing just
fission.
Yeah. Well, yeah, something which is not it's energy that gets used once and then moving on to energy just spread out all over the world, all over the
consumer.
U.S. Yeah,
for
yeah,
consumers.
All sorts of consumer products.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
So there's another really exciting new area. If I can have just a minute
Go
or
ahead.
Two to talk
yep.
about this. It's in the area of energy conversion materials. A little while ago, we were invited by the White House to come for the major announcement. We were at the in Washington, D.C. just a couple weeks ago for this big announcement of what are called energy materials networks. It's Department of Energy, one of Department of Energy's ways of bringing the national laboratories to work together, bringing in industry, bringing in academia to focus on some really important challenges. And the great news is, the very exciting news is that Ames Laboratory was named as the lead for one of these energy materials networks that we call CaloriCool. Calorie energy. Caloric materials and cooling. So we are going to use a new type of material to generate refrigeration or building cooling. It's an energy conversion process. So
again, it would be pretty much an everyday thing for commercial purposes.
Well, we're hoping to get there, right? So energy conversion, you have one form of energy, you want to turn it into another. The simplest example is a solar cell.
Mm-hmm.
You have energy from the sun, it comes down, it interacts with this device, this material, converts the energy from the sun into electricity. What we want to do is we want to use these types of materials, these caloric materials, to do the same thing, convert one form of energy, say magnetic energy, into another form of energy, heat. The ultimate goal of this is to produce a solid-state refrigeration device.
Mm-hmm.
Just like the lighting industry has gone from 100-year-old technology with incandescent bulbs to fluorescent lamps
mm-hmm.
and is now moving very rapidly into the area of solid-state lighting, we think that we can help enable the same with cooling. Currently, air conditioners, all other types of cooling are based on 100-year-old technology, vapor gas compression that uses greenhouse gases. If we are successful in developing these materials that can transform either magnetic energy or electric energy or stress or pressure energy into temperature, we can develop a device that can enable refrigeration, for example. So we're very excited about that. Just kicked off a couple weeks ago.
Well, like I said, Ames Lab is one of the hidden gems of Central Iowa.
Yes.
I'm quite serious about that. This is something that we can all be proud of the types of activities that Ames Lab is doing to contribute to creating a more ecologically
That's right.
based and sustainably based environment.
That's right. That's what we're trying to do.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about how the Ames Lab interacts with maybe some of the less hidden things. What's Ames Lab's interaction with ISU?
Oh, that's a great question, Paul. Thank you. Truly outstanding and quite unique. We've talked a little bit about the 17 Department of Energy National Laboratories. Ames Laboratory is the only one that actually sits on the campus of a university. Others may sit very close, but sitting on the campus truly makes all the difference in terms of cost savings. The majority of our funding by far comes from Department of Energy.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, those are taxpayer dollars. And we want to make the most efficient use of those dollars as we can. And our contract, Iowa State University, has been the management and operating contractor since the very beginning of the lab, 1947. And the benefits we get out of that, the benefits the taxpayers get out of it, are many shared services. So other laboratories will have cafeterias that they need to support, road maintenance, libraries, and so forth. ISU, as our contractor, covers all of that. In addition to those cost savings and efficiencies with some of the business systems, the human resources, and others, one of the greatest attributes is the joint faculty and the student access we have. We have on the order of 75 joint faculty, 100 students.
So they have joint appointments with Ames Lab in either physics or chemistry or some other unit
on
campus.
Like Professor Halk, for example, has part of his funding coming through the Ames Laboratory. At the same time, he is a full faculty member. He teaches classes. He has students and postdocs.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the Ames Laboratory mission, that inspire minds to solve problems. We are part of that. We have many internal programs. We have a summer program where we bring interns in from around the country. We work with local community colleges and have interns come in as well. We have a wonderful Science Bowl tradition. We've been hosting the High School Science Bowl for 25 years now. And in great news, Ames Middle School won for the second year in a row and will be heading off to Washington, D.C. in April to compete in the national competition. We've got wonderful outreach, and it's all because of our partnership with the university. And one other thing that we are extremely excited and enthused about is Ames Laboratory just completed construction of its first new research building in over 50 years. Our first new building of any type in 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
We're a small laboratory. We have a very focused mission, and we were able to make a very compelling argument why this new building was needed. It's called the Sensitive Instrument Facility, and it is designed specifically to do just that, house very specialized, very sensitive equipment will be disrupted by any type of vibration or electromagnetic interference. Must have great temperature and humidity control. So Department of Energy funded Ames Laboratory to construct this building. It is placed on Iowa State University land out at the Applied Sciences Complex off of Ontario Street on a very long-term lease. So we have this great building. Now we need to find some funds to put equipment in so that we can use it to enable our science. Well, Department of Energy contributed very generously to three new pieces of equipment. Ames Laboratory royalty funds from that lead-free solder contributed quite a bit as well. And then many departments and colleges and central administration also contributed to funding one of the truly specialized world-class state-of-the-art instruments. Those have all been delivered. They are being installed now. We're going to have a building dedication grand opening in early May. Again, this partnership between the laboratory and the university is remarkable.
It sounds it helps to keep everybody more efficient. It helps Iowa State to get some of its research done with assistance, and it helps Ames Lab to operate at a lower cost budget than some of the other labs.
That is correct. Yes.
This is quite exciting, Paul. What do you think?
Well, with the sensitive instruments, just the one thought I had is that reminds me very much of what I was reading about the instruments that were used to detect gravity waves recently. That you need to be totally isolated from anything else that might be causing that. You're not working in astronomy or astrophysics at all, so you're not trying to. I don't think you're trying to detect things from far away, but you are trying to detect properties which you can only find if there's no disturbances.
And, that's actually at the other extreme from the astronomical scale. Many of these instruments are used to look inside materials, metals and alloys and ceramics and even biological systems down at the atomic scale. So we can image columns of atoms and be able to make those correlations between how materials are put together and how they perform.
Kind of like the Genome Project of Elements.
It is exactly that. In fact, the White House initiative is called the Materials Genome Initiative.
Interesting.
Rather than putting human cell behavior together, the goal is to be able to accelerate materials design and discovery and implementation all the way through deployment to get materials out there into service much faster.
Well, thank you for sharing. This is your host, Jim Werbel, and we've been talking to Adam Schwartz, the Ames Laboratory Director, and Tom LaGrasso, the Deputy Director. This has been a fascinating conversation.
Thank you, Jim and Paul.
Yes, our guests in the first hour were the first half hour were Steve Karsten, Ames Lab Public Affairs Manager, and Sam Hoek, Ames Lab Scientist and ISU Chemistry Professor. The show was engineered by Richard Morrison and co-hosted by me, Paul Hertz.
If you've started listening late and are interested in learning more about the Ames Lab, you can listen to the whole show by going to our website, khoifm.org. Tell your friends about this show as well and have them listen to it. It's you, the listener, that makes KHOI a vibrant part of our community. The music on this show was from the CD Walkie Talkie by Air, and we've also heard The Elements from Tom Lehrer. Thank you for listening, and thank everyone for being here.